Them?
Yeah, them. The lowlifes who just spent 8 hours of this precious one-way trip we call life watching schlock. I'm in your heads, folks, and you're never gonna get rid of me. Every time you see a movie with a cheap set, I'll be there. Every gaping plot hole or monster costume with a zipper, I'll be there too. Fact is, we've always been here. We're the ones who sucked all the art and replaced it with trash. We're the ones who fill your life with so much noise and visual clash. You can't tell the good from the crap anymore. Maybe the truth is out there, but we've mixed it up with so much other stuff, you're never gonna find it. You are alone in this whirlpool of meaningless images.
Quick question, though. How can they be alone and you're always with them whenever there's like a plot hole?
Shut up, Max. I'm on a roll here. My point is, your minds have been skillfully mismanaged since the beginning. You are not a person. You're just a data point. And with all the multitudes working to amuse and distract you, there is no one taking the time to look out for you.
Wow. That's sobering.
Yeah.
Happy heresies and welcome to the desert of the real. Hope you enjoyed that germane clip from Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's exactly what is being done to us by the Archons. This series remains an outstanding modern representation of Plato's cave. Heck and Hecate, it's the only occasion when Patton Oswalt is somewhat funny.
That's sobering.
Ah, Torgo and Ator and the rest who have appeared on the show. You are more logical than the parody that reality has become today. And any reality is still a shadow on a cave wall. Our task is still to go up and out of the Black Iron prison and into the sunlight of possibility and potential. Nothing has changed in ancient times or here in the 20s, in this Philip K. Dick world, Age of Hermes and Gnostic times.
Well, it's not really a measure of mental health to be well-adjusted in a society that's very sick.
I got 99 problems and being trapped in a decaying body in a money-hungry society on a dying planet in a mysterious dimension might be one. Or as Stacy Martin wrote, I find myself homesick for a place I do not know, but somehow have not forgotten. Lastly, as the caterpillar told Alice, you are a terribly real thing in a terribly fake world, and that, I believe, is why you are in so much pain.
The world breaks everyone, and afterward, some are strong at the broken places.
But worry not, you veterans of 1,000 psychic wars, you of the broken places. We're figuring this out and exiting the shitty cosmic movie theater. How do we do this? I'll get to that soon. But first, thanks for arriving at a special district of the virtual Alexandria.
This is blasphemy! This is madness!
Aeon Bignostic Wadio, an initiation by conversation into the dark corners of myth, magic, and meaning. A crash course in cult culture and conspiracy. A virtuous virus invoking and informing history, holiness, and heresy. Each week I, your host Miguel Connor, commandeers your connection to bring you the most accepted and rejected scholars and provocateurs to your attention. Fun, compelling, and deeply weird, this is the blow-your-mind cocktail party conversation you always wanted to listen in on. And you deserve to be here, for you are a shining, crazy diamond that should be seen and can ignite the universe with so much wonder.
Will our clits explode?
As Hemingway said, there is nothing noble in being superior to your fellow man. True nobility is being superior to your former self.
I'm excited to host the brilliant and insightful Carl Abrahamson, again in this eternal now. He will discuss his latest book, Source Magic, The Origins of Art, Science, and Culture. As always, Carl kills it when it comes to panning for that Gnosis gold in the rivers of the marginalized and mysterious, the sacred and the profane.
No way! Yes way!
One of Carl's underlying themes in his new book is the importance of shamanism for any healthy society and any collective human consciousness. Notice this isn't happening much in our modern times. You embracing your inner shaman is crucial to any gnosis.
We are dreamers, shapers, singers, and makers. We study the mysteries.
Like Gnosticism, shamanism isn't a religion per se, but a spiritual modality, a metaphysical orientation that attaches itself to surrounding cultures and theologies. It's a parasite faith, the holy but infectious plasmate of Philip K. Dick, if you would.
That's sobering.
Shamanism and Gnosticism ask us to look at our inner worlds full of planted constructs and hidden authentic selves, and outward to dare the spiritual realms for treasures to enrich the tribe. Shamanism and Gnosticism are transgressive, fringe, and rebellious, but in the end, they stand between humans and the gods, mediating for the two sides and ensuring they don't exterminate each other.
A beautiful morning. Poseidon has blessed our voyage.
Sometimes the gods bless you in the morning and curse you in the afternoon.
In fact, shamanism and Gnosticism might be the same, even as they both are the only traditions that understand how to manage the most essential of archetypes, the trickster. And you know how on this show, I've more than proven that the trickster is our only hope today, as he or she will doom our culture unless we integrate them into our soul. It's as simple as that.
What do you get?
I don't think so.
When you cross a mentally ill loner with a society that abandons him and beats him like trash!
Call the police!
I'll tell you what you get!
Call the police!
You get what you fucking deserve!
To understand shamanism and Gnosticism a little more, let me quote from April DeConnick's The Gnostic New Age. The native ecstatic impulse is very ancient in the Mediterranean religions. However, it was bolstered and reframed when the Greeks made contact with early Siberian and Mongolian shamans, who were specialists in the otherworld journeys. Stories from the Greeks tells us that historical contact with Mongolian shamanism was made at least as early as the 6th century BCE, when Abaris, a shaman from the north, visited Greece and deputized the famous philosopher Pythagoras. Shamans who lived north and east of the Mediterranean, in the regions of Western and Central Asia, were traditional religious specialists known for their ability to access the spirit world during induced moments of ecstasy.
Some people lose their faith because heaven shows them too little. But how many people lose their faith because heaven shows them too much?
The shaman's soul was practiced at flight through the underworld and the multi-layered heavens as it sought from the spirit's knowledge of therapeutic remedies for individuals within the community. The centrality of ecstasy and knowledge to the shaman's profession is discernible in the Tungus word for shaman, which some have argued means both knower and raver.
No way!
Because of their ability to cross the threshold between our world and the other world, some shamans were believed to be psychopomps or guides, escorting newly deceased souls to their final resting place in the afterlife. The shaman gained his status as an ecstatic healer through complicated initiatory ceremonies that allowed the shaman to commune with the spirits, even to shapeshift into their animal forms.
I read members of Gnostic sects offered their bodies as a release from the material world.
It was not long before people across the Mediterranean had developed their own plans for invading, before death, the realm where humans do not belong. Religious rituals, often elaborate, were set in place, These pre-mortem rituals were meant to break down the human body and reconstitute the person in a form viable in the other world. They were meant to traumatize and raise the body so that a different, suitable body could be formed as a replacement, and the initiate could be reborn a transfigured creature.
It could be the amplification of the individual, the multiplication of individual existences, parallel existences, now with the individual no longer restricted by time and space.
The Gnostics believed they had Gnosis because they had found and met the hidden God directly by undertaking an ecstatic quest. What was shocking was that the God they found was not numbered among the gods of the Babylonian, Egyptian, Jewish, or Greek myths that were being worshipped in the temples down the street.
The people desert the temples. They turn from the gods.
What gods? You prophets and priests made the gods that you may prey upon the fears of men.
Although it is abundantly clear that Gnostic spirituality was forged in ecstatic fires, it is less easy to identify the exact fire, particularly when considering how eclectic Gnostics were. In addition to personal revelation, Gnostic systems were fashioned from various religious and philosophical sources. The first Gnostics were pluralists, drawing from any tradition or source that helped them answer their existential questions. So we have thousands of footprints, but no animal.
Yaldabaoth, a lesser god, a blind god. He created desire and love. He created guilt, pain, and even death, and the chains that bind us. But none of that is real.
Let us to our interview with Carl. Let us find our source magic, our inner shaman, and light the fires of ecstasy to play with the trickster. Write your own gospel, live your own myth.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
Will our clits explode?
And now we come to the most alarming delusion of all. Imagine a cave where those inside never see the outside world. Instead, they see shadows of that world projected on the cave wall. The world they see in the shadows is not the real world. But it's real to them. If you were to show them the world as it actually is, they would reject it as incomprehensible. Now what if, instead of being in a cave, you were out in the world, except you couldn't see it? Because you weren't looking. Because you trusted that the world you saw through the prism was the real world. But there's a difference. You see, unlike the allegory of the cave, where the people are real and the shadows are false, here, other people are the shadows, their faces, their lives. This is the delusion of the narcissist, who believes that they alone are real. Because other people are just shadows, and shadows don't feel. Because they're not real. But what if everyone lived in caves? Then no one would be real. Not even you. Unless one day you woke up and left the cave. How strange the world would look after a lifetime of staring at shadows.
This is the Aeon Byte interview, and with us we have the pleasure and the honor of once again being joined by Carl Abrahamson, this time to discuss his new book, Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. Carl, thank you very much for coming back.
Thank you for having me. It felt like it was only yesterday.
Time flies. Saturn is not kind, is he? He eats everything. And with us, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm just fine. It's magic that I can show up this early in California time. So I'm already started.
There you go. All right, Carl. Well, like I said, I enjoyed this book. Tell the audience what exactly is the book?
It is kind of a follow-up to the one called Occulture that came out in 2018, in the sense that it formally, it is an anthology, basically, of essays and lectures and other bits that I've produced over these past years. So that can have a tendency at times to sort of be eclectic and disparate and go in different directions and stuff. But my thinking is a bit limited. It usually stays within the same playground. And what has happened this time is that over these past years, I've been thinking more and more about, you know, what the hell is everything? It's a big question.
Yeah.
But what I mean is that when you look at things from, as I tend to do, from a magico-anthropological perspective, that means that you're interested in magic and how magic relates to human beings and vice versa, and how it affects our cultures and all these things, then you sort of realize that basically everything that we are familiar with today, everything that we are accustomed to today in terms of things dealing with the mind specifically, like philosophy, like religion, like social behaviors, all of it basically stems from a kind of shamanic or even proto-shamanic behavior or cluster of behaviors that has traveled with us genetically and also, I guess, from the time we started writing things down or making images and stuff like that, also in a documented form, but specifically genetically. And what I mean is that the early shamanic behavior, we're talking about caves, we're talking about primal tribes, very small communities, they've always had this person or persons that have gone beyond, that have gone inside, that have transcended and gone on little inner journeys that usually call shamanic journeys, and then they've brought wisdom and information back to the tribe. Back then, we assume, mostly having to do with how do we best survive. And then, you know, as time moves on and humanity becomes more numerous and more complex, then we have this thing that we no longer have specific shamans. We have proxy shamans, in a way, that become the priests or the philosophers or the artists that on their own go on a tangent and go on inner journeys, maybe within organized structures, and then tell people what to do, how to behave, etc. But everything we look at comes from this shamanic source. And that's what, you know, where the title came from, Source Magic. And there's a couple of essays in the book also that talk about this phenomenon specifically, or I wouldn't say it's a phenomenon. It's just something that is, you know, those are our roots. So we can never eradicate that little as we can eradicate other things in our genes and in our communal memory, in a way. So it is very fascinating. And then, of course, I like to look at things also that are going on today, you know, in culture. And I love this word called occulture, of course, like my previous book, but also the actual process, you know, it's called occulturation. Previously, anthropologists have talked about acculturation. When, for instance, two cultures meet and they adapt to each other and, you know, get accultured to each other, or a new philosophy that comes into one culture, etc. But there's also this specific thing called acculturation, where things come from the hidden spheres, where they come from the banned spheres, the spheres that for some reason are ostracized within a culture, because that eventually happens. You know, things grow in the dark and then they come up and it becomes flowers. And that happens also within our culture. So I write a little bit about things that I've come across that I find interesting, and in my own life and in general perspectives also, and about things that are, I consider, worthwhile and relevant from a magical point of view, like, for instance, the concept of pilgrimage, which I see, I think it's something that is very, very crucial, important for people to go on pilgrimages. We usually associate it with, you know, Santiago de Compostela and sort of these established religions, but there can be, on a more private and a sort of small scale level also, that has the same kind of beneficial effect. It's not only that you go somewhere with an intent, but you go with an intent to become replenished or revitalized. And that's usually what happens, because you have that mind frame, you have that intent, whether it comes from meeting a specific person or a specific landmark, something in nature. So it's a ritual, basically. You go there to do something or to acquire something or get something, and then you come back as a new person.
Anyway. Yeah.
So, and basically there's a lot of stuff in there. I sort of talk about Austin Osman Spare, the old British magician that's been very influential, Ezra Pound and magical realism, this sort of literary category, and some thoughts about my friend Genesis Peorage, who died a few years ago. And it's like a little, literally, I hope, a goodie bag. You know, you can stick your hand into the goodie bag and sort of bring out weird little things.
Yeah, there's something for everyone. And yes, like you said, there are some strong themes that come out, that unifying themes, which we can discuss. And interesting about shamanism, because yes, in ancient times, the shaman didn't just have to be, you know, the guy painted who went into the spirit world and dodged spirits to bring back information to save the tribe. He could be the poet, the philosopher. There were different ways a shaman can be. And in our modern era, who would you call a shaman? Because, for example, I mean, you could say Roger Waters or Jimmy Page could be shamans, Terence McKenna, or what is a modern shaman?
Well, I think they're good examples, because they have those three people have the ability, have had the ability, and still do, I guess, not Terence McKenna, but, you know, to bring people into another state of mind simply by conveying what they have through the language that they have. You know, if you're in a huge arena and you have Led Zeppelin, you know, prime era, what that could be, maybe 1977 or something, 76, and, you know, you listen to Jimmy Page playing, it takes you somewhere else. You're not in your normal routine frame of mind. So in that sense, they provide transcendental experiences. And Pink Floyd also, who, you know, catering to the more psychedelically inclined with their majestic shows and stuff like that. And Terence McKenna, of course, thematically dealing with psychedelics. So that's one thing. However, I see it very much as connected not only with the transcendental experience in itself, but also with a dissemination of information or wisdom. And I think that, you know, shamans in our culture could be, for instance, not that I in any way advocate it, but it could be people who experiment recreationally with psychedelic stimulants, for instance, in not as a party thing, but to go, for instance, you know, on an ayahuasca trip or something like that, meaning, again, a kind of pilgrimage where you go into a different state of mind and possibly a different geography also, in order to acquire information and wisdom about something going on in your life and possibly in the lives of others.
Yeah, we call them influencers now, right?
Yeah, you could say that, but it's not a bad point there, because the thing is, when you deal with information of a kind that is not readily accepted by a collective that, for instance, is run by empirical methods, where empiricism has become the new religion in a way. When you're not under that umbrella, then, you know, some people will cock an eye and say that, oh, this is nothing. This is just a fantasy. However, fantasy is very much a part of reality. And I would argue that it's not fantasy. It's an inner journey, an inner experience that we are unfortunately not told to validate. As soon as we're out of the stage of the childhood fancies, then, you know, we were taught that, you know, focus on this. This is real. This is rational. This is, you know, tangible, tangential to our sensory input, etc., etc. And, you know, and then suddenly that kind of validation that, for instance, you get from dreams. That's a good allegory or a good parallel thing. You know, we all dream. Most of us wake up, you know, remember fragments of dreams. We can't really say that they are unreal. We have come up with a term in, you know, post-Freud, etc. It's called, it's the unconscious. It's the unconscious talking to us. Well, if dreams can affect us to the extent that we wake up with in terror or pleased, or even if we're male with an erection or more, you know, then that would give evidence to the fact that it is very much real what we're experiencing in this irrational way. And then you could argue, you know, well, it's just like the brain trying to get back in order. But so what? We experience it as much as when we put our hand on a hot stove and we remove it, because it gives the information, remove it or you will burn, you know, it hurts. So in that sense, the classic shamanic experience, the inner journey, is something you experience on your own. And one of the sort of messages, perhaps you could call it that, one of the messages I do have is that one should absolutely validate whatever you experience on the inner plane. And you don't have to share it with anyone else unless you feel that you want to, because it is you talking to yourself. I do not ascribe these experiences to something external, you know, like spirits or gods or whatever. Or if you call them that, that would go so far as to say those are also human constructions. Those are things that you create. But they are relevant because you get one image, you get one message and not another. It's not a chaos, it's not a jumble, you get something specific. And you could also draw the analogy to when people use what you could call oracular tools, like I guess the most common one today, which is definitely in the mainstream, is the tarot, for instance, right, where you have these some symbols, you know, the symbols are given in a way, like with the I Ching, you can consult a list of meanings. But still, it only becomes alive and relevant when you yourself validate, when you value and validate and interpret. You know, then it becomes meaningful as an oracular tool. It's not something that is imposed from the outside, from an authority. And here, I think this kind of proto-shamanic attitude becomes related to what I know that you're interested in very much, the Gnostic approach, because that is also a distinct heritage from the shamanic, where you yourself go into a direct communication with God or the demiurge or other forces, because it's part and parcel of something that we have later called Gnosticism. It's an ism, and a Gnostic approach. And a Gnostic approach is the same as the shamanic in the sense that it's there for a reason to you know, say grace in a way, be appreciative, show reverence. And then in exchange for that, we get information. And it doesn't come from a priesthood. It doesn't come from a structure. It doesn't come from a control organization. It comes from the depths of your own psyche, or if we want to go that far, from your soul. So you can see that remnants or remains or shards in a way are very much present in a culture that we can look at. And I would say that, you know, the psychedelic journey and how that affected culture, mostly from the 1960s and onwards, definitely kind of a beckoning or a calling from some part of ourself, which says, do not discard the information that you get when you're on an inner journey, irregardless of how you're going on that journey, you know, what techniques or methods or possibly even chemicals. The main thing is to do it, because that, I believe, it's inherent in our survival instinct. We need to go on these things in order to have information to see how we survive, basically. And that's why all of this is so present today, you know, in general, what I call occulture. So like all of these mystery traditions, all of these magical schools, all of these things that have been occulted in a way, they have now, through the process of occulturation, become occulture, and eventually they end up in the mainstream. And I think what's the lesson here is to sidetrack the structures, to sidetrack the organizations, because well, you know, they've had their time, and history has proven them fairly much wrong in a way that they have been tied to quite draconian measures and quite draconian results, you know, if you look at the environment, etc. And it's not, you know, you in Sweden, we have this thing where you say you shouldn't cry over spilled milk, meaning basically, yeah, you know, what's done is done. You know, what can you do? You can't turn the clock back. You can only exist in the present and work for a better future. And I think that there is a reason to why we're so immersed now in spiritual things, in New Age things, in occult things, in alternative religious things, in reverence for indigenous cultures, etc., etc. It's because we need to reassess and relearn how to deal with life in a healthier way.
That's really well said, and agree with you on all counts for sure. And even things that we might not like from where we're standing, Carl, for example, fundamentalist Christians handling, yeah, snakes, or the mega church pastor who can heal people, yeah, or people are speaking tongues. We go, oh, it's like, well, it is, sorry, but it is shamanism. And in a way, it keeps their community held together and sane and safe. We may not agree with a lot what they do, but they are also practicing shamanism.
No, I agree. And I think that what happens is that if you look at those phenomena, for instance, you know, evangelical movements and how they began, you know, like, you know, primitive traveling missionaries that become little clusters and they have their little churches and they have a specialized thing in their tradition, you know, I'm sure you can find really interesting things there. The problem is, as with politics, as with a lot of things within the human mind frame, it's when it becomes corrupt. It's simply the allure of power and money, and sometimes they're the same. That's the problem. So and that's also why I don't, as you know, I certainly don't see myself as a Christian or a monotheist in any way, but I am not one to disrespect what someone else believes in that sense, because, you know, originally it came from the same source, which was still agnostic magical culture from around the Mediterranean area. You know, it's filled with magic and, you know, what I would say, good things, healthy things for the mind and the psyche. The problems always come when someone steps up and says, I will interpret this for you, and you will adapt to the rules of this group that claim that to have the you know, the right to interpret whatever divine or spiritual things there are. And that's when human culture goes wrong, because once corruption in itself has taken hold, it is kind of impossible to uproot. And we see that in cultures, usually when it comes to political things, you know, people cling to power. But it's also very clear, I think, simply when groups become too big. You know, you can have a small religious community, for instance, that are very happy and they work well together. But as soon as you lose touch with the thing that I call the source, which is this individual journey to enlightenment or to information, then it becomes very muddled, you know, and someone will always see, whoa, here's a chance for me not only to control people, but also to make a buck. and that's really what's going on. So I think, you know, if you're referring to like holy rollers or right. other kinds of sideshow attractions that may have had some real, you know, as you say, shamanic substance that may come from something genuine, became commodified at some point. And again, there you have it. You have the mega churches and the TV pastors, and it's just and they just represent a scam. It's all about getting poor people usually to pay their hard-earned dollars to someone who don't need it.
Exactly, and it's a tale as old as time. I'm sure there were times when in ancient time the shaman kept more of the food. Of course, you've got the priest and the king who had all the nice rooms and money and all that. Don't you almost admire the old prophets from the Hebrew Bible, like Isaiah and those guys, living in the wilderness, living like hippies, shaking their fists like Grandpa Simpson at Jerusalem, like, get your act together. Mm. Those were cool shamans, huh?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. That there again, you're talking about, you know, myths that are still vibrant and vital for people who live in those religions, for instance. You could use them as models or as archetypes of how to behave when it comes to these things. But also it's very culturally structured, because you can also have monastic cultures are interesting, for instance, because originally they were not corrupt, but still it was based on the agreement that if the community provides for the monastery, whether it's Buddhist or Christian or something else, you provide for us and we will have this particular space as a spiritual or religious repository, and we can learn things and we can develop our faith or our system, which will also benefit you. I have no insight into how Christian monasteries function today. I know they exist, but I've been to Tibet, for instance, and also been to Tibetan environments in India and Nepal. And there you can see how that actually works. It's like women and men being at school, in a way, actually sort of university level of spiritual teaching and doing work for the community. And for that, the community gives them what they need in terms of food or money or sustenance. And it's an interesting thing that is also a memory or a remnant or a remain from a much, much, much older way of dealing with things, meaning it's not using the spiritual experience as barter. It is simply a communal service that is part and parcel of the totality that needs that to be healthy.
No, it makes perfect sense. And here's a question I probably should ask. How do you define magic, Carl? I mean, obviously very popular today is sort of the Dion Fortune. Magic is the science of altering consciousness in accordance with the will. And it makes it kind of elastic, because you could include Nazi propaganda or corporate advertising or psychology, or you can include so much more today. But how do you define magic?
Mm-hmm. It's the best question ever. I love it. And it is, I have given it a lot of thought. And again, you know, it was there before Crowley, but Crowley said this thing, you know, it's a, you know, the art and science of causing change to occur in conformity with will. And then you have various derivations and variations of that theme. But I think that can become too crass. It can become too causal. It can become, you know, when we think about it, based on our culture with fairy tales and stuff, we want a bit of drama. We want a bit of romanticism. We want a bit of, again, transcendence. And I think that's really a key to it, because human beings need transcendence, and not necessarily by proxy. They need to experience transcendence themselves. So I think that the if I were to say this, and I have defined it, I'm not sure it's the perfect definition, but I say that magic is a mind frame that allows for all other definitions to pass through it, meaning that it's an individual thing, you know. But if you ask me, which you did, to define it, I would need some kind of extra layer, something that is literally fantastic, something that is out of the ordinary. It can certainly have to do with my own intent or someone else's intent in question, because that's how we sort of become accustomed to think about it. You do something supernatural to get something. You do something out of the ordinary. But it could also be something that takes you to a place of feeling or experiencing, like watching a movie that just blows your mind, or being out in nature and it's so beautiful that you cry, and you turn to your friend or friends and you say, "This is magical." That happens quite often, you know, when people say that she's really magical. That film was magical. So what they mean by that, it means that it's out of the ordinary. It means that it evokes an emotional reaction in the person who is, you know, partaking or watching this thing. And I don't know, now I'm speaking in English, and we're talking about basically a Western Anglo-Saxon perspective where we are used to saying that. You know, I say that many times a day. And if you think about it, you do probably too. And friends of yours, you know, "Wow, that's a magical thing. Wow, what a magical piece of music." You know, because it takes you somewhere else. So it has that potential and capacity to make you transcend your normal rational frame of mind. However, if we were to stay there alone, if we were to stay with that definition, then we sort of lose the thing that is actually driving it, the original, you know, impetus. And that is, you know, to change something, to turn one thing into another. And we have it symbolically, and I guess also realistically or in real experimentation, at least with the symbols of alchemy, when you take something dross or base and you turn it into gold. You know, I'm not so sure that it's possible to change, you know, lead into gold, but I if I can see it, I will believe it.
You would be living in a mansion right now, not talking to me.
Yeah, exactly. Or any other kind of symbols of transformation that our myths are so filled with. But if you look at it as that, as symbols, then that sort of defines our understanding of magic. It is about changing something into something else. And therefore, we have the kinship with art, for instance, that has the same kind of immediate modes of behavior and how it works, because you either take something and change it, or you really put your hand into an empty hat and bring out a rabbit, you bring out something completely new, which is what an artist does in a way, either, you know, transforms something existing or comes up with something entirely new. And of course, everything has its origins somewhere, and we could, you know, just for the sake of it, accept that the human mind and the human soul, or whatever we want to call it, is kind of indefinite. It has infinite depth, and we can bring things out of it, and it's fantastic. And the people with talent, creative talents, that can give this form are very much the magicians of our culture. And I think they have been since that dispersion of the original shaman, in a way. Artists have been the real proxy people, as have the pioneering scientists, because it's the same thing there, you know. You have an idea that comes from somewhere, and you give that idea form, and you formulate it so that other people can take part of it, or it can be used or exploited or whatever for the benefit of the greater community. So it is a very tricky thing to define. But again, I would say that, you know, magic is the mind frame that allows all definitions of it to pass through it, because it can be so many things for for different people. But I think, you know, the transcendental aspect is one thing, and then that it is connected somehow with change, with bringing intent into the picture, whether it's just one, you know, greedy little amateur magician, or it's something very, very altruistic and big goals that some community of magical people are working towards.
Oh, yeah. It's like talking about love. I think the fun is discussing it and experience it. Same with magic or even time. What did Augustine said when somebody asked him, what is time? He's like, if you don't ask me the question, I know the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense. And I mean, all these highfalutin philosophies, in a way, that are not immediately beneficial to our life on a day-to-day basis, meaning, you know, in a way, quite decadent philosophies,
yeah,
that don't bring something immediately to the table. However, that is part of high culture, because when we can allow people who have that capacity to think and formulate lofty ideas, then that's the sign that we are beyond the Stone Age, that we don't have to fight and grovel in the dirt and, you know, just kill our enemies and rape their women and whatever, that we're not primitive, basically. And I think that one of the most interesting eras from a magical anthropological perspective was, of course, the Italian Renaissance, when all of these philosophers from the Mediterranean region, whether it was from Greece or Egypt or the Mideast and beyond, actually, brought stuff into the existing mind frame that allowed for that to exist, sometimes even in defiance of the Catholic Church. And that was a flourishing, flowering culture in so many ways, that we look back at it through historical records and saying, this is kind of a peak moment in human history. And we could look at things that happened later also, you know, with the Baroque music, Baroque art in the 17th centuries, you know, and later also, that, you know, where art becomes something that drives people to new levels of thinking. So someone could be inspired by a piece of music by Bach, for instance, and come up with ideas in completely different field, simply because the culture allows for, again, I would say, a transcendental experience where something is so beautiful that you're overwhelmed, and that in turn gives you something. You might be a mechanic or a smith or a writer. You know, it gives you inspiration to come up with ideas, although the original force was in a completely different form.
Yes, indeed. I would agree with you on that as well. And another chapter which I liked, you have a chapter on magic realism. And I think that's also important, especially in the West, North America, Western Europe, that we sort of embrace. I mean, I grew up in Mexico and other places. So, of course, I read a lot of Jorge Luis Borges, Gabriel mm-hmm. Garcia Marquez, all these guys. And it wasn't even the literature, Carl. It was the life. I mean, for example, yeah, my mom and I could be waiting at a corner for this lady that was going to bring us fruit. And we'd be like, you know, why are you late? And she's like, well, the devil came and tempted me. And you didn't even ask. You just said, okay, sure, that's your reality. Yeah, you met Satan. He wanted to steal your fruit. Can we now haggle?
Yeah.
So it's part of the culture. And it's a nicer way to live, don't mm-hmm. you think? Maybe explain about magic realism and how it can help us today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's usually our first association when you have these two words, you know, magical realism. It has become a literary category. And you mentioned Borges and Marquez, and there are many others also from different cultures. You know, the Japanese have great magical realists, and they're all over, basically, if in case you can actually put them under the same umbrella. But what I mean, and what was the sort of the spark for writing this particular chapter, is about usually when we are taking part of culture, whether it's movies or literature or whatever it is. It's like we're used to being presented with a narrative that has, actually the narrative has a form. So if we read a book and we know it's fiction because we recognize the name of the author, so we expect a narrative that is fictional, that will give us a bit of repose and you know, take us somewhere else temporarily while we read it, whether it's a short story or a novel, you know. And if it were a book about something, it would be clearly stated that this book is about that thing. But magical realism is very, very interesting, because usually when we talk about novels, well, it's fiction, but it's not poetry. Poetry is something that is formally upheaving your expectations. You have to go into the form, and the form has to be attractive and alluring for you to get to the end. If it isn't, like too experimental or too, you know, I don't know, complex, then you just sort of lose interest. Whereas a good author that writes fiction will lure the reader into the web and move the reader forward through the story, through the narrative. Magical realism has this thing where there are things that are not quite right. You know, yeah. There is something out of the ordinary, something off key, something that is could be dissonant or simply too weird or too fantastic. It doesn't belong there. And that sort of for some people makes you curious to say, whoa, this is really interesting, what the hell is this, and you keep reading. And for other people it's like, whoa, this is too weird, I'll read a Stephen King book instead, you know, or something else that you sort of feel comfortable with, because you basically know what's going to happen, both in terms of form and content. That's interesting, the kind of effects that magical realism can have. And I believe that it can be also applied on daily life in a way, or our daily existence, meaning that small, odd changes can bring great benefits to our lives. And again, we return to this thing, you know, the source magic aspect, that small deviations, small transcendences or transgressions even can bring great benefits to our life experience, to our psyches, development, to our individuation, meaning you're not stuck on the same path that probably someone else has pointed out to you. But you could also sidestep, you can go on a tangent, you can jump and skip, or you can go on a bike or a fast car. You can do things differently, and that in that sense there's a kinship there with the literature of magical realism, where again, very small changes can create great effects. And then I, in the same essay, I also change the words around, which you can only do in one way. Basically, that's calling it real magic, you know. And what is that then? Well, and I compare that with, for instance, the slightly negative effects of the form of news media, for instance, and of commercial advertising, meaning they use forms that are convincing enough to make you believe in what's being said or sold. An example can be the form of the material that comes from a cell phone. Nowadays, the cameras are so good on cell phones, but we can still discern, say that this is something that someone shot with their smartphone. And when we see things like that in the news, you know, shaky, handheld, right, usually portraying something violent like abuse or beatings or even war, you know, then we immediately, through the form, accept that it's real, that it's true, so to speak. Whereas if we have something that is completely pastel colored, streamlined in 4K or 8K, high definition, well lit, etc., then we immediately assume or take for granted that this is fiction. So the form has a lot to say with when we interpret the images that comes from others. And all of these things are used for manipulation. For instance, in propaganda, you know, you can have fake smartphone images, or you can, you know, in various ways manipulate how the material looks and thereby how we interpret it. Commercial advertising is another such, you know, morass of where people, this classical thing is that, you know, why are they repeating the same message? It just makes me angry. But when you're in the aisle and you choose a product, that will still be the name of the brand that you will pick, because it's like pure indoctrination.
Right. Yeah.
So things like that, I think that, you know, it's better to learn that by changing a few things in your own narrative, you can learn a lot more about yourself than if the narrative is completely straight and narrow. And it might even be a narrative that's been given you by someone else. What I mean by real magic, it's not necessarily that reality as such is harsh and negative, but one should also be aware that the realism of the real can also have magical implications, meaning of a negative kind, that someone is trying to affect you, to indoctrinate you, or to sell you something by similar things. You know, usually when you if we were to describe a commercial, for instance, it's a family, they're happy by a table, and they're eating food, and you can see the food they're eating. If with a different soundtrack, it could be from a sitcom. You know, right. from with a different soundtrack again, it could be a documentary. But we are accustomed to sort of have the entire form convey a message that these people are happy. They eat super flakes, so you need to buy super flakes also. That's basically it. And then of course I love magical realism. I love that kind of fiction, because I think it affected me, and I think that's the spark of me writing it, was that, for instance, I love Borges. It's kind of, you know, what is it? Well, if you really want to analyze why it's so fascinating, it is because it's out of the ordinary. It's out of the expected.
Oh yeah, and you mentioned examples that people can relate to here in the West: William Burroughs, Hermann Hesse, to an extent, yeah. You say George Orwell.
Yes.
For the audience, I don't know, Carl, if you've seen Paul Thomas Anderson's film Magnolia, 1999.
Yes, Tom Cruise, I've seen that.
But
yes,
that's a perfect example, because you have a movie that has internal logic. It's very secular, whatever, and all of the sudden in one scene it rains frogs, and mm-hmm. you don't find out why it rained frogs.
Yeah.
There is no reason, it just rains frogs. And as strange it is, the raining of the frogs actually helps a lot of the character development and their decisions for their healing and individuation. And people go, well, that movie made no sense. Why is it raining frogs? And I'm like, does it make sense that in that movie people were doing drugs and cheating on each other and hurting each other?
And yeah, all and lying, this illogical, lying to themselves.
Yeah, yeah, dysfunctional destruction. But the frogs don't make sense.
Yeah,
you know, it's the other way.
It should be. Yeah.
I think that's a perfect example.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to clarify, what we both mean is that scene is completely out of the ordinary, but the film in itself is not surreal. You know, it's not like a Buñuel film or classical surrealism where everything is just cuckoo crazy. That's something else. But Magnolia and other films like that, they have a straight narrative, but something weird happens that displaces you, that sort of challenges your expectations. It's a disruption of belief in a way.
Exactly. Eraserhead.
Yeah, I mean,
that's sure. That's a real from beginning to end, right?
Not really.
He's kind of that's ordinary, drab industrial thing, and he's got his girlfriend and all that, and it fades in, you know.
Yeah, no, it's very special, but I see what you mean, because it's although surrealistically inspired, it does have a pretty straight narrative. It's someone's anxiety and depression that is just overwhelming, and it takes on a formal expression through the cinematography and the scenography and just the
child
acting. Yeah, the child. The weird child. Yeah, and the lady singing, and you know, it's dreamy.
Yeah, you just if you substitute a real baby for the Eraserhead baby, it's probably more obvious, you know. Mm-hmm. Although the lady in the radiator, that's totally surreal, but that's his dream. Right?
That's a dream, exactly. And many you know, standard narratives have dream sequences, and I think, you know, one shouldn't question why people artists do things, but it could be like a trick or a gimmick or a method to displace temporarily, but it's a displacement that is more readily accepted because it's so clearly stated that it's a dream. You know, someone goes to bed and has a dream about this thing that happened during the day, then we expect it to be weird because we have that categorization, the dream.
Yeah. Nobody has normal dreams, right? I had the weirdest dream.
Yeah, exactly. And it was magical.
Yeah, magical. That's true. Yeah, David Lynch is definitely in his own category. And even when people ask David Lynch, can you give us a summary of your film? He's like, my film is a summary. Watch it. It's like he's not going to go any further.
Yeah.
Never. Never.
Never.
How about The Prestige? Do you like that movie?
That one I haven't seen.
Oh, you got to see that.
The Prestige. Okay,
it's
when
about
is
magic,
that from?
Right?
It came out a long time ago, in 2000 somewhere. It's got it's got Wolverine in it, you know, Hugh Jackman.
The Prestige. I'm going to
Christian Bale, Michael Caine, Scarlett. Right. Oh, it looks like.
Oh, whoa! Yes, I've seen that. That's a great film. Yeah, it's sort of England in the late 19th century, right?
There you go.
Yeah, no, that's a good film. That's a good film.
Yeah, it has a bearing on all the things that you've been talking about, about reality.
That's true.
Magic.
This brings us to something that certainly relates. Again, for the audience source, magic has a theme that you will find for your life and the culture surrounding it. But in ancient times, the shaman just didn't go on a walk about a pilgrimage and get all the treasures for his tribe. He had to deal with naughty spirits, evil spirits, what the Gnostics would later call the archons, and so forth. And obviously in magic realism, these things that pop out, like Satan popping out of nowhere, frogs falling on your hair, they sort of upend your life and change your reality. And this leads right into an important figure I feel today, and that is the trickster, Carl. And you have a chapter on the trickster, Luz Pernox, based on Loki. So do you feel the trickster is as important as we talk about? I mean, Hermes transformed the Renaissance, right? And he was sometimes a trickster. So
absolutely.
I think we need the trickster. What do you think of Loki, and how can we learn from this magic, realistic god?
I think it's absolutely super, super, super quintessential. I cannot stress enough how important the trickster is. And that also brings in the devil figure, or, you know, the antithetical figure or symbol or force. It is so important for the overall health of the human being as an individual, and the community, and the culture in general. And I think that the problem with the monotheist cultures is that it's simply become too extreme in its diametrical approaches. It's so dualistic, you know, it's only God and Satan. There's not really much in between. Whereas in the polytheistic cultures, you have a wide spectrum of psychological qualities given form through the various gods. And I think that's in a way healthier, because it gives you as a citizen or as a human being, the opportunity to sort of have your favorite god, or feel like that god or goddess today. And it's sort of, it's a little bit more psychologically insightful than only dark and light. However, it's pretty obvious, and, you know, you could look at it from the point of view of business as well. You know, if we have one company developing one thing, mastering that, and then becoming anxious not to let go of the market shares that are 100%, that's usually called a monopoly.
Right.
And some, you know, it can be great, but it does become a little bit inert, because you maintain something, but why would you need to develop something when there's no need for it, when people are happy to swallow the commercial advertising and buy your product? Then you have something called competition. Competition drives the general culture of whatever it is you're doing forward. And this, an upstart or a rebel or someone who leaves the monopoly company says that basically, F you, I'm going to start my own thing. And then basically comes up with something that makes the old inert thing go, whoa, we have to react to this too. Otherwise we'll lose market shares. And then there's a kind of a war, you know, and on that level, it's good. It's good. It brings something good, perhaps an improved product that will make people happier in a way. And of course, it's also good in the monopoly of religion, because if you don't have the devil figure, some kind of satanic force, then everything will just be, you know, tyrannical. You will have a tyrannical daddy god who tells everyone what to do, and everyone accepts it. And if people don't accept it, they will be severely punished or ostracized or banished. You know, I know it's a simplification, but that's basically how I look at it. And then you have Loki is not a god, but he's still housed in the pantheon of the Asa gods in the sort of the Nordic pantheon, as a, you know, sidekick almost to Odin, the main and highest god, who is also very much a shamanic god, a god of magic. And I raise the question or the speculation in my text in the Source Magic book, you know, whether Loki is not actually a part of Odin's magic. Well, definitely, but maybe even a part of Odin, because if you're a magician who is so advanced in those approaches of shape-shifting and just being completely fluid, as the young people would say today, malleable in their existence, and using different and very experimental methods in achieving whatever it is that Odin wants to achieve. I think that for the overall psychic health of the environment of the Nordic gods, Loki is there to provoke. And I believe that Odin knows that it's needed, but he himself, as being the big daddy of that community, cannot allow himself to be fully, you know, ridiculous, fully irritating, fully threatening. But Loki has that gestalt, in a way, that persona that can be that force, the satanic force, in a way. And that's basically what that chapter or that essay is about. And it's also more to do with the Fenris wolf, which is a very interesting factor or force in the, again, Nordic pantheon during Ragnarök, which is basically the apocalypse. You know, the Fenris wolf devours the sun and things end, but everything starts anew, because it's in that kind of religion or philosophy where things are reborn, you know, rebooted, just like the sun comes up in the east, then a new civilization will emerge after the apocalypse, in a way. So the Fenris wolf is usually seen as something negative, because it has connotations to the end and violence and disruption and things like that. But all of these forces that push things onward to that critical moment, they are needed in order to make it happen. Otherwise, they cannot be a development into something new. There cannot be a rebirth. There cannot be a reemergence of power and health and things like that. I mean, that's how we function also, in the sense that we are born, we become adults, we sire our own babies, and then we die, basically. That's the sad trajectory.
We all have a Ragnarok.
yeah, we all have a Ragnarok, exactly. But that said, you know, there's some things you can't really do anything about. You know, you have some medical advances, but we all die. You know, that's just the sad fact. Or maybe it's not so sad. It's just something to accept.
Well, awesome. Well, audience, as you can see, there are strong themes in Source Magic. You'll get some messages on how to help the world, unified messages we're talking, and something will jump out for you that will enlighten you. But we are at the end. Usual suspects to get your book, Carl, or anything you want to mention?
No, not really. I think it's always a bit of a dilemma when you put sort of eclectic different pieces together, but I'm very happy with the book because even though it's sort of is ranging from a lot of topics and stuff, there is a red thread in there, and it's really, it's a good title, Source Magic, because it all boils down to how we relate to what we experience, whether it's through culture or literature or big political things or just spiritual things. It's basically all the same because they're all parts of our own experience and other people's experience that they have tried to formulate to share with other people. And that, I think, is an essential part of what I call source magic. You have to go to the source, and the source is something that is accessible to everyone.
All right, wonderful. Well, we will have show notes where you can get more information on Carl and his book, and definitely check it out. Well, Carl, once again, thank you very much for coming on the show and giving us your time and your gnosis.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure, and we'll talk again soon, I think.
I hope so.
And there you have it, you shining crazy diamonds. Carl's enthusiasm is only matched by his acumen, a hunk of burning gnosis. In our second part, Carl will continue talking about the trickster in Ragnarok. Fate and fortune, baby. We'll pivot to the legacy and impact of the Gnostic TV series, The Prisoner. Then Carl will contemplate on the 1960s. What went wrong and what went right? What can we still learn from that decade and what lingers from it? This will lead to what, as magic users, we can do today to make the world more magical. And yes, we'll cover shamanism in our second part. So please become a member for the full Vision Quest. It's only $6.99 for AB Prime, a lunar cycle, or $4.99 at Red Circle, or whatever you want to pledge on Patreon to meet your needs. You'll get access to my private Facebook group and Discord channel for AB Prime members and higher level Patreons. If you find value in this content, please support this Red Pill Cafeteria. Your help can be in the form of some shekel donations on Stripe or the US Mail. There is also a link on the show notes if you want to leave a tip via Stripe or on any YouTube show. If you want to help via Bitcoin or other crypto, reach out to me for an address. If you need help with all or any of these choices, just message my ass. I'm always here to help, and I truly appreciate your help. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true shaman self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.